after the end of Interval with Francis Davis, which we hear every Thursday, usually at 3:30, but we did hear it a half hour early today so that we can present a special live 90-minute workshop and performance of jazz and classical music with cellist David Aegis and saxophonist Byard Lancaster, who have been playing together since 1979. We'll be hearing a duet performance of compositions by David Aegis as well as classical chamber works. Lancaster and Aegis will also talk with us about their approach to composition and improvisation, the interplay of jazz and classical music, and the development of their music careers. Though Aegis is now a jazz musician and composer, he's classically trained, a graduate of Boston University in the Manhattan School of Music. He studied with George Nykrug, Benar Heifetz, and studied chamber music with the original Hungarian string quartet. He's been composing jazz and leading his own groups since 1975 and has recorded his last two records on his own label, Music Unlimited. The first of the two albums is called The Arrow, and it features duets on his compositions with Byard Lancaster. The second, Crossroads, adds drummer Sonny Murray to the group. Aegis is one of the few jazz musicians whose primary instrument is the cello. Byard Lancaster is from Philadelphia, a graduate of the Berklee School of Music, who also studied at the Boston Conservatory. He's worked with Sun Ra, McCoy Tyner, Wilson Pickett, and Milt Jackson, and recorded with Sonny Murray, Bill Dixon, Larry Young, and Johnny Copeland. In addition to being a member of the David Aegis Trio, Lancaster now leads his own funk band. It's called Philly Funk. You may have also heard him on the streets in Philadelphia. He's played on Broad and Chestnut Streets. Aegis and Lancaster will be in residence at the Painted Bride Arts Center. The residency is sponsored by the Atlantic Richfield Foundation through Chamber Music America. WUHY Radio and the Painted Bride are co-sponsors of this residency and this concert and workshop this afternoon as part of that program. There will be a concert that you're invited to this Saturday night at the Channel 12 studios, and a couple of workshops you're invited to as well. More about that later. Well, let's listen now to a live performance from the WUHY Music Studio with David Aegis on cello and Byard Lancaster on flute.
Thank you, Terry, for inviting us to the studio, and we'd like to start our performance with the title tune of our duo record called The Arrow. Thank you. Next composition we'd like to do is something by Hector Villalobos called The Jet Whistle, or in Spanish, Asobio a Jato. We're just going to play the first movement of this, The Jet Whistle.
Thank you.
Now we're going to return to another original composition of mine called In the Garden. In the Garden.
Thank you.
We've just heard a set by composer and cellist David Aegis and saxophonist and flute player Bayard Lancaster. And they'll be with us until 5 o'clock this afternoon. They're in residence at the Painted Bride Art Center, and this is through the Chamber Music America in a grant that's co-sponsored by WUHY and the Painted Bride Art Center. And before we talk and before we hear more music, let me just tell you about some of the upcoming events that's part of this residency. There'll be a concert at the Channel 12 studio this Saturday night as part of this series, and you're invited to come. It's free and open to the public, and it will begin at 8 o'clock. And for any more information and to make a reservation, which you'll need to do if you want to come, you should call the Painted Bride at 925-9914. That's 925-9914. And more information about the upcoming jazz workshops a little later. And there's more music to come, solos and duets with David Aegis and Bayard Lancaster. Well, I enjoyed that, and I want to thank you both very much for that very enjoyable set. How did you both get together, David?
Well, I heard Bayard play in a big band. I think it was led by Ted Daniels, wasn't it, Bayard?
That's correct.
And that was at Ali's Alley, which is a club in New York run by the drummer Rashid Ali, who is also a native of Philadelphia. And I was actually looking for an alto saxophonist at the time, and I was very impressed with Bayard's playing, and asked him to come up and do some rehearsing, and we rehearsed for a few months, and then we did a concert, our first concert in March of 1979, so that's how we got together.
Has the collaboration affected your music in any way, Bayard, do you think?
Definitely.
And in what ways?
So many ways, I can't even name them. A concept, I imagine, Terry.
Uh-huh.
That's the first thing.
Have you played with a cello before? It's unusual to have jazz cellos. It's still an instrument that very few jazz musicians play. Was it different for you to adjust to playing with a cello?
It's the first time to work with a cello. I have recorded with Bill Dixon and cello in a band and played numerous people in New York, but the first time I really worked with a cello and able to hear it and watch the music and see the range.
David, you've been composing pieces, especially for yourself and Bayard, and some with the addition of Sonny Murray. Does it affect your composing to know exactly who the people are that are going to be playing one of your pieces?
Oh, yes, very much so, Terry. As a matter of fact, I'm composing particularly for these people that I am performing with because I know their particular abilities on the instrument. I know the sound that they get, know the kind of textural quality that they have. And so the compositions are really designed for these musicians in particular, and I'm very fortunate to have these people play my compositions. It's also great to have musicians right there so you can write something one day and hear it the next day. I mean, I think, of course, Ellington was a famous example of that. I mean, he always wrote for the people in his band, and he was always writing music for his particular players, and that's what he likes so much, is to be able to have the chance of writing for everybody in his band and hearing it right away, because many composers don't have that opportunity, and I'm very glad that I have it in a small context that I do.
Bart, when you get one of David's compositions and you're going to be playing it for the first time, how do you look at it? What are you looking for, and how do you approach it that first time?
Well, let's deal with the 1984 concept, Terry. Because of business and travel and many things to concentrate on, I prefer to have the melody first, played by the composer, followed by an additional rhythm part in a period of weeks or months so that I can learn one line at a time on cassette tape or tapes, and then a discussion about what the piece is and the concept. And then I would like to approach it with my saxophone, flute, or another instrument and have the choice of deciding how we want to spell this out in the program.
So you really want to get it in your head before you actually start playing it?
Yes, I deal a great deal with the tapes because it saves a lot of time. I play them constantly now.
Maybe we can talk about a specific composition of yours, David, and talk about what it was like to compose it, and then maybe hear it afterwards. When you're improvising from one of your pieces, are there chords? Do you have a structure that you're improvising off of? Is it like in bebop where you'd be improvising off the changes?
Well, not exactly, Tara. Usually what there is there's a certain kind of melodic element or rhythmic element in the composition that is supposed to direct the composition in a certain way. That is the improvising on that composition in a certain way. And also what happens is Bayard and I discuss the improvisation, so we have certain points of reference that are happening, so we know that we're going to be here at a certain place and here at another place, and so the whole thing hangs together. But what I'm really looking for is that the composition and improvisation fit together in a way so you can't even really tell which is which. I mean, that there's kind of like a seamless whole, and that, you know, the composition and the improvisation is so connected that the improvisation is really like spontaneous composition, which is, you know, what it can be when it's really happening.
When you're improvising on one of David's pieces, are you thinking about anything in particular, or is it a question of like letting it happen, or are you thinking of like the chords or the melody or rhythm that happened before?
I think it's only maybe 10% of let it happen. We must make it happen. And there are also some statements I want to make since I'm the soloist. And I put that in also, you know, whether it has to do with the composition or not, and what day it is, and what composition is going to follow. For instance, if we're going to just play one composition, then I might want to scream that day, so I scream and let it out anywhere. But if we have a regular program, then I know I'll be able to express myself fully throughout the other compositions. So you must pace yourself, develop a form and a concept, and set your climaxes.
Do you usually play similar solos on the same piece when you play it again?
Yes. I mean, it saves time. And also, David has 100 and some compositions. So, I mean, where's imagination stop?
When you're both improvising, or when one of you is improvising, you've got to be not only thinking of what you're going to play next, but listening to the other person as well. Can you talk at all, David, about what that process is like of having to listen to what's happening and think of what you're going to do next at the same time?
I think when it's really going very well is one isn't really thinking in a certain sense. I mean, I think one is actually just sort of in the groove of the improvisation, and that, you know, that you know where the other person is just by instinct. And particularly in a setting like this, in a duo setting, which does obviously only involve one other player, it's much easier to hear exactly where his musical imagination is going, particularly if you have rehearsed and performed as extensively as Bayard and I have. So it's really not a question of listening and then thinking, well, Bayard's going to go here, and then I'm going to follow him there, and then he's going to follow me here. But it's more like sort of two parallel roads just going along at the same speed, and, you know, one takes the high road and one takes the low road, like the old Loch Lomond song.
What's the worst thing that can happen in improvisation if it's not working well? I'm sure that has happened sometimes.
I think what happens when an improvisation isn't working well is it loses focus, and that the original musical idea is not developed or transformed in a logical way. And I think that's what happens when the improvisation isn't working well. But it happens less and less as one goes along. Of course, one gets better. And this is, you know, a great thing of being able to have people like Byard and Sonny play my compositions all the time, because we continue to know the compositions better, to know each other's musical imagination better. And so that percentage of, you know, diffuseness or lack of focus in the music gets less and less as we go along, which is very satisfying.
Well, I'd like to ask you both to play another one of your compositions, David. And maybe before we hear it, maybe you could discuss the composition and let us know if there's a structure that you'll be improvising from.
Right. Well, the next composition we're going to play is called Sweetness is Beauty. And it's a very simple folk song kind of theme, really. And in fact, this composition is one of the few compositions I've written that involves chord changes. And we do improvise on these chord changes. And this is what we'll be doing when we play this composition.
Thank you.
Well, that sounded terrific. That was Sweetness is Beauty, a composition by David Egiss with Byard Lancaster on alto saxophone, David Egiss on cello. I really enjoyed that. What I'd like to do is speak with you both each separately for a while and then ask you each to take a solo, and then a little later on in the afternoon we'll be hearing another series of duet performances. And for anyone who's just joining us, my guests are David Egiss and Byard Lancaster. We're broadcasting live now from the WUHY Music Studios, and a little later I'll tell you about a special concert that they'll also be doing this Saturday night. David, you are classically trained. Why did you leave the classical music world?
Well, I felt that the classical music world didn't really offer me the freedom to express my own musical self that I was really looking for. And what happened was that I felt that playing the same master compositions, which they certainly are by Beethoven, Brahms, and Bach, and all the other classical composers, but they had been played so many times that I felt like they had sort of become codified in a way that everybody was playing them by rote, and there really wasn't that much to add in the way of interpretation. So when I listened to jazz, I found this wonderful freedom of spirit that made musical sense, particularly records by people like Miles Davis and John Coltrane, Charles Mingus, and so I listened to these records many times, and what happened was that these records made a big impression on me, and I wanted to continue and delve into this music. So that's really how I left the classical field and became more of an improvising musician.
Do you think of your music as chamber music now?
Well, I think that with the duo, we are really both in the jazz and classical idioms in a certain sense. That is, some of the compositions, or many of the compositions, are using improvisation, but there are a couple of the compositions that are through-composed that we play. In fact, the next composition in the second set that we'll be playing is a through-composed composition called Yesterday, Today, Tomorrow. And so I think with the duo, we are really on the sort of cutting edge between the jazz and the classical idioms. And I think that many people are doing this. I mean, I think there are many jazz players like Byard who are exploring classical music or contemporary classical music, and there are many classically trained people like myself who have been exploring jazz. And I think that the lines between the two musics are sort of blurring, and I think that there's a whole development happening, which we're certainly a part of, being really an improvising ensemble, basically, but we are still under the auspices of this chamber music America, and so we are really combining both the perhaps textures and structures of classical composition with the freedom of jazz improvisation.
Would you be able to play for us on your cello an example of how you're combining the different sound and bowing, plucking techniques of classical music and of approaches to guitar and bass and...
Well, I think what's happened as far as my cello playing is concerned is that I've developed a pizzicato style that is plucking the cello that is transformed from the guitar or the bass. And when I play something like we just did Sweetness is Beauty and I go like... That's certainly a kind of guitar lick, which I've transferred onto the cello because I used to play blues guitar on the guitar. So now I'm transferring those kind of guitar stylings onto the cello. And so I think what's really happened as far as my cello technique is concerned is that I've expanded it instead of changing it. And that is, I've, you know, retained the classical bowing techniques, and but I've added some plucking techniques, which are generally not used in the classical idioms, to just expand my sound colors.
When you're composing, do you use any of the standard forms, either of classical music or of jazz or pop, like the 32-bar form or the canon or fugue form? Do those, are those useful to you in any way?
Well, I don't use those forms particularly, but I do have used forms. I mean, for example, this Sweetness is Beauty piece that we just played is a blues, and Yesterday, Today, Tomorrow is in three movements like many classical pieces, although in this case the slow movement is first and then the fast movement is in the middle, so it's not like a Mozart symphony where usually the fast movement is first and the slow movement is in the middle. But I, you know, use all the knowledge that I've gained over the years from classical and jazz and listening to all kinds of music. I mean, Eastern music, Indian music. And I think some of these structures appear in my music, but they're usually transformed in a way, so I don't, you know, usually use a canon or a fugue just like an imitative way. But I think that I probably use certain structures transformed.
Could you play a solo for us?
I certainly would. This is called Routes, Territories, Destinations. And this is in actually three movements. And it's about traveling, routes, territories, destinations. Thank you.
Thanks. We just heard a composition played on solo cello by David Aegis. And if you're just joining us, we're in the middle of a 90-minute performance and workshop with cellist and composer David Aegis and saxophonist Byard Lancaster, who's also playing flute as well as saxophone this afternoon. In a little while, we'll be hearing a series of duets. Also, Byard Lancaster will be playing a solo for us. First, I want to mention, if you'd like to hear their music this Saturday night, there will be a concert in the Channel 12 studios, and that's on 6th between Arch and Ray Streets. The concert will be free and open to the public, but you will need to make a reservation. And the concert is co-sponsored with the Painted Bride Art Center, and if you'd like to make a reservation, you can call them at 925-9914. Byard Lancaster.
Yes.
How did you know you wanted to be a musician? Was there a point where you knew, this is it, I want to be a musician?
I saw a man across the street playing tenor saxophone, and I wanted one. And I was approximately 4 and a half, and I got it about 5 and a half.
That's pretty young.
Yes.
Were you able to manage it when you were that small?
I struggled. It fell out of the case a great many times.
How has jazz, funk, rhythm and blues, pop music, classical music entered into your early playing? Like when you were five and in your formative years, what were you listening to, and which musics really influenced you and helped form you at that time?
Well, Terry, I think I was born to play, and I've heard everything just about, because I travel a great deal. But I grew up on Sharpening Street in a community called Dogtown, and we had jazz clubs at that time that existed. That's 30, 40 years ago. And they still exist, the same clubs. And they always had bands each month, and they still have bands. And I heard it, and then the marching band was on my street. And my sister plays the piano and sings, and we were both in the elementary school orchestra at Emlyn Elementary. And in Roosevelt Junior High, I was in the band and also in the jazz group with Kenny Barron. And in high school, I had great people who went ahead of me, like Jimmy McGriff and Archie Shepp and Reggie Workman, J.R. Mitchell.
We heard you a little earlier play a piece by Villa-Lobos. When you're playing a classical piece, do you find that you change your approach at all? Is your embouchure different and the reed you're going to use different than it would be when you're playing a jazz piece?
Did we play it? I'm still worried about it.
Oh, did you not play?
Yes.
I'll have to hear the tape back. Uh-huh. Yes, your concentration is always going to be different with each piece. Especially with instruments, I'd prefer just to play the flute. But I started on the saxophone, so I get hired to play the sax. But your concept changes for each piece, each composer. Just as the composer would write for a soloist, the soloist must interpret the composer, you know. And we learn each other's rhythms melodies and things like this.
You've been playing for many years, since you were five. At this point in your musical life, do you go home and practice, or has the meaning of that changed?
I try to go home to rest, but I practice all the time, on the street, on the bus, on the subway, on the airplane, because of the sound ordinances now. I have to sing a great deal because they don't allow radios and instruments on the subways anymore. But for years, I've played wherever I am. I take my piccolo. I have it here today. I've played it in the middle of Germany and met musicians, and I've seen musicians that I knew, and they heard the sound. And I think that the aspiring musician must practice at least 2 hours a day, 6 days a week, maybe five. And the one who wants to be semi-professional should get 3 to 4 hours a day. And if you're professional, it is a major part of your life.
So what does practice mean to you now? Does it mean playing your music, or actually like doing scales? Or
Depending on the time, most of the time, in most situations, the first is to have the calisthenics or the warm-up. And the second would be to detect your technique. But quite often I'm in the studio or performing, so I must also know the music. So I must go directly to the music at times. But I have many systems for practicing. The object is to keep the instrument in my hand at least 4 to 7 hours a day, and to practice whenever possible. I enjoy practicing more than performing.
Really?
Yes, definitely.
What do you think that is?
Well, this is what I must do. It's just like a fighter. He has to work for 6 months to fight for one, 15 rounds in one night. So I like to enjoy life, so I put the emphasis on making the work more enjoyable than the performance, because there is more work involved. It's like if you're going to run 1 mile, you have to run 2 or 3 miles to have the energy for that 1 mile practice. So you don't want to think that practice is a job. So it is a... Plus, I've learned from Sun Ra, and he says that you must practice every day like eating every day. If you're going to feed your spirit, you must have some music going on. And I realize this is a body chemistry, and it changes when I do perform. And the birds sing every day, as it is a chore. And many tribes throughout all cultures use the music as a tool rather than just entertainment.
In addition to, you've played in several bands, but you've played like with Wilson Pickett, and I wonder if the sound that you've gotten in a band like that is a different kind of sound, if you're aiming for something different.
That was a rare performance, but I've played in many types of bands in that.
We've got your groove. Own funk band now.
Yes, definitely. And that dance music is completely different. You have to put some of the technique in your pocket, forget certain chords, forgetting certain ideas, and remember the idea of show business.
Do you move like from a different world to another different world, depending on what kind of music you're playing?
Definitely, definitely. More than you realize, because as a person, early this morning we were in the studio recording funk, very early this morning. And when I come here to perform, then I must say, change my mind. Just like changing the TV channel. It's still the TV, but you have to put a new channel on.
So you've got a lot of different channels.
I hope so. We're working on, I have a number of new albums out, and I'm working on, now I'm just about finished my funk album, and we're going to production in the first year to do a gospel album, and then from there to an orchestra or something like that. It's like newspapers and magazines. We must keep coming out with new products. This is a very competitive world.
Do you find that music means something different in the different worlds, like in the world of funk or classical music or avant-garde jazz?
Definitely, definitely. It means something different to everyone. Some people are naturally in tune with music. Some people only use it once in a while. Some people can't use it at all. And some people work it, and some people use it for a pastime. And the entire world runs by rhythm. So your heartbeat, the seasons, the tides, the moon, whatever. And this is in tune with astrology, et cetera. And when you understand those melodies, it's the first melody is hearing your partner's voice, or your boss's voice. These are the sounds. The first instrument is the mind and then the voice.
What about your voice on your instruments? Do you feel that it's the voice you naturally have, like the voice you speak with, or is it a voice that you've developed from a sound in your head?
I've just begun, at 40, I've just begun to find my voice.
I've played many types of music and played for many people. And this is one reason why I was in New York, is to bring home a library of compositions so that I can see what everybody else was doing. And as I begin to form my own compositions and orchestration, and I think the orchestration is most important because it dictates the politics of the day, just as Bach and Beethoven did, you know, and the conductor, the first chair. This is politics, the president, the vice president, the mayor, the governor, whoever.
Can you play a solo for us?
Thank you. I would like to briefly play what I've been fortunate to play in Philadelphia on the corners of Broad and Chestnut. And I think this was the best advertisement possible. And I got absolutely no slack from the local police for playing on the streets, because many cities you cannot play on the streets. And in Paris, when we do, you need a pass. And some days I've collected hundreds of quarters, and people who are interested in hearing a melody or just that I'm out there trying to hustle to get some car fare to go back to New York or go into the studio or something like that. And I say that because I plan to be out there Saturday morning. But this is just a connection of melodies. No special key, no special reason. I'm just doing it on time. But these are some of the melodies that some of the people might recognize. The first has been my theme song for a number of years.